In the early morning hours of March 18, 1990, two men dressed as police officers arrived at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston, Massachusetts. After convincing the security guards to let them inside, the men restrained the guards and spent the next 81 minutes moving through the museum. By the time they left, the thieves had stolen 13 works of art worth $500 million. They disappeared without a trace, and more than 36 years later, none of the stolen artwork has ever been recovered, leaving investigators searching for answers in what remains the largest property crime in United States history. Hey everyone, welcome back to Detective Perspective. My name is Derek Levasseur. I'm a licensed private investigator and former police detective. Each week I'll be covering an unsolved case in story format. I'll then give you my perspective on the investigation and provide contact information for the individuals or organizations connected to the case so that if you have any tips, you can contact them directly and maybe you can help solve a case. So if you're someone who's interested in true crime, specifically unsolved cases, and you would like to hear my opinion on those investigations, please consider subscribing, whether you're watching on YouTube or listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever platform you use. Okay, so for tonight's episode, I'm not going to use the word excited to cover this case, but I have been wanting to cover this case for a long time. And for our 150th episode, I've decided to do it. And this is going to be a different episode. This is does not involve a missing or murdered person. This is a property crime, essentially. This is a robbery. And I'm really looking forward to getting your thoughts, your feedback back on this one. I think some of you will be interested in it and some of you will not, but both opinions are welcomed. I want to hear your thoughts. I want to hear your feedback and let me know if it's something that you would like me to do again in the future. I know it won't be across the board either way. And candidly, as long as it's not hated by everyone, I'm probably going to do it again because it is something that fascinates me. Mystery, unsolved cases, and anything that makes me think outside the box is something I'm drawn to. And I have a passion for this. This is what I've been doing since I was 20 years old. And candidly, it does get a little doom and gloom always covering murders and missing people. I know it's necessary. I know it's something I have to continue to do. But I think every 100 or so episodes, if I'm allowed to throw one of these in there, I'm sure most of you will be fine with it. And I do have a lot to talk about. This case, like I said, is from Boston, Massachusetts. And I do have a curveball to throw at you guys at the end of the episode during the perspective. And for most of you, even if you've heard of this case before, I think it's going to be a surprise because the information I'm going to reveal is something I've never shared before. So we have a lot to talk about. Let's dive into this week's case. In 1903, art collector and philanthropist Isabella Stewart Gardner opened a four-story museum in her own name in Boston. She wanted to educate the public about art while showcasing her collection of more than 2,500 pieces, including paintings, sculptures, and decorative arts. For the next 21 years, Isabella lived on a private floor of the museum while continuing to buy new works and change the installations. By the time she died in 1924, she had acquired approximately 1,600 pieces for the museum. The museum meant everything to Isabella, and she wanted it to remain open for the education and enjoyment of the public forever. So, she set up an endowment to operate it and left very specific instructions in her will about what should happen to her collection. Isabella said nothing in the galleries should be changed, and nothing could be acquired or sold. Basically, after her death, the museum was supposed to stay exactly as she left it. And that's exactly what happened. The museum followed Isabella's wishes to a T, even going as far as not having theft insurance because if something was stolen, they couldn't purchase anything new to replace it. By the mid-1980s, the museum still had the same 1,600 pieces, now worth billions of dollars. This was both a blessing and a curse because art museums were getting hit hard by thieves at that time. Between 1985 and 1988 alone, the number of art thefts doubled, and the underground international art trade was operating at its highest level ever. In fact, every art museum in Massachusetts with a Rembrandt painting had been robbed except for the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum. Knowing the risk, the Gardner Museum hired consultants to help upgrade its security. They added closed-circuit cameras at the entrances, motion detectors in the galleries, and more guards to the staff. But there were still major security problems. There were no cameras inside the galleries, only motion detectors, and the guards weren't required to have any experience or training. They were also paid just slightly over minimum wage, and we all know that saying, right? You get what you pay for. And many of the guards were young men in their late teens or early 20s, and the night shift was especially relaxed. Guards would break protocol by letting friends or the pizza guy inside, and some would smoke weed, drink, or play games while working. And obviously, that created a major security risk. By the beginning of 1990, the museum knew there were still problems with the guards and the security system, so they were in the middle of a full security review. But before that review could be completed, the museum was hit by the biggest property crime in U.S. history. On the morning of March 18th, 1990, the daytime security guards arrived at the museum to relieve the night guards, but no one was at the security desk. This was obviously concerning, so they called 911, and the Boston police responded to search the museum. As they started looking around, it was immediately clear that the museum had been robbed. There was shattered glass and cracked and empty frames throughout the galleries. Officers continued searching and eventually found the two night guards in the basement. One was handcuffed to a steam pipe and the other to a workbench, and both had duct tape wrapped around their heads with space left for them to breathe. And if you're watching on YouTube, you're probably seeing some pictures of this as I'm talking about it. For example, there is a picture of these two security guards still wrapped up with the duct tape that law enforcement must have taken before removing it, which we could have a different conversation about that, but it happened and the photos are out there. And there's going to be also images of the museum at the time when this occurred. And I also want to put it out there that there's a lot of fascinating material online about this robbery. There's interactive websites where you can go on and actually walk through the museum virtually and see all the artwork as it is right now. And you can also see the empty spaces or empty picture frames where the stolen art had been. It's really, really fascinating. So I strongly recommend you go check it out. But we will have some still images of those websites throughout this episode. Okay, so back to the two security guards. Their names were Rick Abath and Randy Hestand. Both were in their mid-20s with no formal security training. Randy was a student at the New England Conservatory, while Rick played in a rock band and was known to sometimes show up to work drunk or high. When the investigators asked what happened, the guards explained that their shift started at 11:30 p.m. the night before. Rick made the first rounds through the museum, while Randy stayed at the security desk. At one point, an alarm went off on the fourth floor, so Rick went to check it out, but he didn't see anything suspicious. By approximately 1 a.m., he had finished his rounds and returned to the security desk while Randy started his. Then, at 1:24 a.m. on March 18th, two men pushed the buzzer at the museum's side employee entrance. They identified themselves as police officers and asked to be let inside. Rick could see the men on the security monitor, and they looked like legitimate police officers wearing hats, coats, and badges. They told him they were responding to reports of a disturbance and needed to ask the guards some questions. Even though it was against protocol, Rick buzzed the men in. He explained that because it was St. Patrick's Day night in Boston, the idea that police were responding to a disturbance didn't seem unusual. Once the men were inside, Rick called Randy over the radio and asked him to return to the security desk. When Randy got back, the officers told Rick that they had a warrant for his arrest and asked him to step out from behind the security desk and stand against a wall. They handcuffed Rick and then did the same to Randy. At that point, the men told the guards, quote, "This is a robbery." They wrapped a duct tape around their heads, leaving space for them to breathe, then took them to the basement and handcuffed them there. The guards remained in the basement until they were found by the real police officers later that morning. With that information, Boston police called in the FBI, and investigators began going room by room through the museum to determine exactly what had been stolen. On the first floor, the thieves took only one piece. It was from the Blue Room, a small gallery room with low ceilings. On the second floor, they entered the Dutch Room, which contained some of the museum's most valuable artwork, and took six pieces. They also went to the Short Gallery, a narrow hallway on the other end of the second floor, and they took another six pieces. And that was it. In total, the thieves stole 13 pieces of art, ranging from approximately 130 to more than 3,000 years old. At the time, the stolen artwork was valued at approximately $200 million. Today, it's valued at approximately $500 million. And listen, putting value aside for a second, even though it was only 13 pieces, this would be considered a massive amount by comparison, right? Because the FBI had a top 10 art thefts list, and the most stolen items in one robbery, aside from the Gardner case, was four. So think about that. We're talking about essentially three times the amount of any other case behind it on that list. And because the museum held so many expensive, irreplaceable pieces, investigators expected to have a top-of-the-line security system, but as we know, it didn't. There were no cameras inside the galleries, only at the entrances, and even those cameras didn't help because the thieves took the surveillance VHS tape before leaving, so investigators had no footage of the robbery at all. However, they did have the museum's motion detectors, which recorded movement throughout the galleries. Using those records, along with the physical evidence, investigators were able to reconstruct what they believed happened. And again, if you're watching on YouTube, you're going to see an actual photograph of this transcript that shows these different motion sensor occurrences. So it's pretty interesting to follow along. And there are some questions about what was documented by those motion sensors. And so let's go through that because I do think there's a lot there to unpack. So after tying Rick and Randy up in the basement, the thieves made their way up to the second floor, going directly to the Dutch Room. So that tells us that they had at least a surface level familiarity with the museum. They knew that the Dutch Room was the gold mine. That was the sweet spot where there was going to be some expensive pieces. But I will say right from the rip right here that just because they knew where the expensive pieces were, it doesn't mean they had an extensive knowledge of art itself. And there are indications that, in fact, it was the opposite. And we will get there. At 1:48 a.m., they entered the room and began removing some of the museum's most valuable artwork. First, they took Rembrandt's Christ in the Storm of the Sea of Galilee, his only known seascape, and A Lady and Gentleman in Black off the wall. They placed both paintings face up on the floor and then use a sharp blade to cut them out of their frames. Next, the thieves removed what they apparently believed was another Rembrandt, but the painting was actually Govert Flink's landscape with an obelisk, which had been thought to be a Rembrandt until the 1980s, and this time, instead of cutting the canvas, they just removed it from the frame. And by the way, guys, just a disclaimer here so I don't get chewed alive in the comments, I don't claim to be an art expert. I did look up these paintings and I tried to get the correct pronunciations, but if I get one or two of them wrong, I do apologize. I mean, no disrespect. The thieves then moved Vermeer's The Concert to the middle of the room, and at that point, they held the frame and glass face down, removed the canvas, and then let the empty frame fall to the floor. You see, The Concert was special because it was one of the only approximately 36 known works by Vermeer in the world, and it was valued at approximately $200 million. It has also been described as, quote, the most valuable stolen thing in the world. Still in the Dutch Room, the thieves also removed a postage stamp-sized Rembrandt self-portrait etching from the side of a chest and then spent approximately 5 minutes removing it from its frame. Before leaving the room, the thieves removed another Rembrandt self-portrait from the wall and they leaned it against the chest facing the wall, but for some reason, they left that painting behind. Now, my only guess would be that they were grabbing a lot of stuff, and because they faced it away from them toward the wall, they probably forgot that it was there. And that also tells me that they didn't have an inventory. They didn't have a manifest, a certain painting that they were looking for, because if they had, they would have grabbed it. They were just grabbing what they thought was valuable based on what appears to be a limited knowledge of artwork. They also tried to take a Shang Dynasty vase, but it was anchored down to the floor and they couldn't remove it. So instead, they took an ancient Chinese bronze beaker dating back to the 12th century BC. And there's a lot more to talk about. We have more paintings to discuss, and we're also going to cover some theories, but we're going to dive into that right after the break. Ready to grow or streamline how you run things? Square is offering listeners up to $200 off Square hardware when you sign up at square.com/go/detective. Again, that's square.com/go/detective. Start with Square and build a setup that grows with your business. Listen, I've talked about Square before. We use it whenever we go on the road. We use it at CrimeCon. It allows me to upload my inventory, make sure that it's accurate, set the price points, and ensure that, you know, based on what we're spending on the merchandise, that we're charging enough for it so that we're at least breaking even. And the technology has been seamless. It's always worked. It's been reliable. And that's the number one thing. When you have customers waiting, you don't want the experience to be unenjoyable, because even if the product's good, they may not come back. But Square does everything. You can take payments, manage inventory, schedule your team, track reports, all in one connected platform. No switching tabs, no separate logins, just one place for your business to live. Square lets you start selling in person or online, from your counter, your phone, your website, or even through delivery platforms. You can take chip, tap, swipe, Apple Pay, invoices, all through one system. And Square now offers three clear plans: free, plus, and premium. So you can pick the tools you need right now and then grow into more when you're ready. And sellers who use Square software see 9% higher sales on average. Square helps you run your business more smoothly, bringing payments, operations, and insights together in one place so you're ready for whatever's next. Right now, listeners can get up to $200 off Square hardware when you sign up at square.com/go/detective. That's square.com/go/detective. Get started with Square and build a setup that works the way you do. All right, we're back from break. And so let's keep talking about what was taken. So after the Chinese bronze beaker was taken, one of the thieves walked through another gallery filled with incredibly valuable and rare masterpieces without taking anything. And they continued on to the short gallery, where he stole 5 drawings by Degas. Now, I don't know why he did this. I don't know what was the rationale behind going completely past some of these really rare pieces. Could it have been that there was some sort of list where they were instructed to take a few drawings from Degas, potentially? Or maybe it was just a convenience factor. Maybe the Degas were easier to procure and store on their way out the door. I don't know the exact pieces that were basically passed by, those rare pieces. Maybe they were larger and this was more of a convenience thing. We won't really know until we find out who did this and if we're able to speak with them. The thief also tried to take a Napoleonic battle flag, but it was screwed into the floor, kind of like the vase. So instead, he removed a nearly 10-inch tall bronze eagle from the top of it, and then he returned to the Dutch room to meet up with the other thief. And at some point, someone entered the blue room on the first floor and removed Manet's Chez Tortoni from its frame. And now I say someone and not the thieves, because the motion detectors never recorded anyone entering the blue room while the thieves were inside the museum. And this was odd, as investigators knew for sure that the motion detectors had been working shortly before the robbery, because Rick triggered them while making his rounds. Investigators also tested the detectors for themselves and confirmed they were working after the heist. So they really had no idea how someone entered the blue room, stole the Chez Tortoni, and left without triggering the motion detector. They weren't sure if the thieves were the ones who went into the blue room and took the Chez Tortoni and somehow didn't set off the motion detector, or if it was Rick who had taken it while doing his rounds. And that was something they had to look into. For now, investigators only knew for sure that before fleeing the museum, The thieves returned to the security desk where they left the empty Shea Tortoni frame and removed the surveillance tapes from that night, but no other nights. And you might be asking yourself, why would I stress that they didn't take the tapes from any other nights? And on the surface, I get where you're coming from. It all occurred in 81 minutes. Why would they need the tapes from the other nights? As some of you part-time detectives have already put together, if there had been some reconnaissance, some surveillance done prior to the robbery within the prior days or weeks, these thieves would know that their faces would be on camera somewhere and potentially could be tracked down that way, because if the FBI or the investigators working this case are doing it right, they're going to go back and look at who had visited the museum in the last couple days, last couple weeks, maybe the last couple months. So what this tells me is either they just didn't think about that, or they weren't concerned about being identified because they never entered the museum, which would indicate that there's at least one other party that hasn't been identified. And so after the thieves went to the security desk and took the tapes, they went back to the basement and made sure that Rick and Randy were still handcuffed and duct taped. Then at 2:40 a.m., they opened the same entrance they had used to get inside and made two more trips to unload the stolen artwork into their vehicle. At 2:45 a.m., they officially left the museum for good. And as I mentioned, in total, they had been inside for 81 minutes, which was an extreme amount of time considering most art thefts lasted less than 3 minutes. And that wasn't the only thing that baffled investigators. Despite stealing some incredibly valuable artwork, the thieves didn't appear to be experts who had been hired to target specific pieces. For one thing, they left behind the museum's most valuable painting, Titan's Rape of Europa. They also stole several items that were worth significantly less than other pieces that were sitting nearby. Investigators believe that the thieves may have planned to use the stolen artwork as a bargaining chip, and this wasn't just a wild guess. That exact scenario happened multiple times previously in Massachusetts, specifically with Rembrandt pieces. In those cases, criminals stole Rembrandts and later used them to negotiate lower sentences with prosecutors. And a little hint for the perspective, I may know of a guy who did this. In fact, the first guy who did this. We're going to talk about him, don't you worry. And investigators believe that the Gardner Museum thieves may have had this exact same plan, but they didn't anticipate how much attention the robbery would receive. See, because they weren't art experts, or at least that's what people believe, they likely didn't realize that they were committing the world's largest art heist or that it would become international news. Basically, the FBI didn't think that they were dealing with professional art thieves. They thought it was more likely that these guys were regular career criminals who had gotten in way over their heads. And based on the information that we do have, that does appear to be the case. And I will say, one thing that really stood out to me, just based on some of the research that I did with other art heists that were similar to this, obviously a lot less pieces. One thing you wouldn't want to do is destroy the art pieces. Yeah, you may take them out of the frame, but you're not going to cut the canvas, right? That's going to extremely devalue the artwork, the painting. And a professional would know that and have a respect and care for that. And it almost seems like after they did it the first couple times, one of them said something like, we can't do that. That's not going to help us. We're going to lose a lot of money. And that's when they started removing the rest of the artwork from the frames. So again, if you're someone who does this all the time and you're a professional, you're going to know that going into it, and you're going to target specific pieces, more than likely the most valuable pieces, right? Definitely the number one piece in the museum. And yet they didn't do that. So I do agree with the FBI's assessment on this one. And now that the investigators knew exactly what pieces had been stolen, the full investigation began. The museum was processed for evidence, but it was difficult from the beginning. The thieves hadn't left behind any footprints or any obvious physical evidence. And while investigators found fingerprints basically everywhere, because you have patrons who are going through the museum and then other employees, it was difficult to determine whether they belonged to the thieves or they belonged to someone else. And of course, there's also a possibility that none of the fingerprints found belonged to either of the thieves. If they had any brain cells whatsoever, more than likely, they were wearing gloves. And you would think that Rick or Randy would have confirmed this. I tried to look it up and see if there was anything. I didn't find anything that would substantiate that claim. But there's also a possibility that even if Rick and Randy said, yeah, they definitely had gloves on, investigators still wanted to process and check for fingerprints everywhere, because there's also a possibility that even though they initially wore gloves for the encounter with the guards, maybe they were stupid and maybe they took them off because it was easier to access the paintings from the frames upon doing so. So you never know. If criminals were smart, they wouldn't get caught. Although we're sitting here all these years later, since 1990, and these guys haven't been caught. So maybe they're smarter than we think. So with no solid clues at the crime scene, investigators turned their attention to two people who had been inside the museum when the robbery happened. Guys I just mentioned, Rick and Randy. And they seemed like the most obvious people to look at. So investigators interviewed both guards multiple times, repeatedly asking them to go over what had happened that night. And they kept repeating the same story, that they had taken their turns doing their rounds, during which time the quote-unquote officers showed up and robbed the place. Investigators were eventually able to corroborate at least part of their story. Several people who had been outside the museum that night reported seeing two officers wearing hats, coats, and badges. Like Rick, they believed these men were legitimate police officers. A group of teenagers also reported seeing a red Dodge Daytona parked near the museum shortly before the robbery. Inside, they saw two men dressed like police officers. With that part of Rick and Randy's story corroborated, the guards helped investigators create sketches of these so-called police officers. Rick believed the taller man's mustache had to be fake, so investigators released one sketch showing him with a mustache and another without it. And I've put some sketches up here. I don't have the one without the mustache, but I do have two sketches of these individuals. I believe it's both parties with their mustaches. But even with that information, investigators still needed to determine whether either guard had any connection to the thieves. They closely examined Rick and Randy's personal lives and connections, although it's unclear whether they found anything significant. What we do know is that both guards also took polygraphs. Randy passed his, while Rick's results were inconclusive. And after that, investigators seemed to move away from Randy, but Rick remained on their radar. They were suspicious because he had broken protocol multiple times that night. Not only did he allow the supposed police officers into the museum, the motion detector data also showed that he had opened a different side door, breaking protocol again not long before the thieves arrived. And as far as I can tell, everywhere I've looked, there has never been any explanation as to why he did that. And then there was that mystery that I mentioned earlier surrounding the Blue Room, where Rick was the only person recorded by the motion detectors entering the room that night, even though by this point, investigators knew for sure that the Chez Tortoni was stolen from inside. But even with all of that, Rick maintained that he had nothing to do with the robbery, and he was never charged with any crime related to the heist, and he passed away years later. And I did look into that. He was around 56 years old. It doesn't appear to be anything suspicious, and I believe it occurred in Vermont. And we're not done. We still have more to talk about, including the most prominent theory surrounding this case, and then I got my own perspective on what may have happened. We'll get into it after the break. If you've tried everything to lose weight and you still feel stuck, this summer can be different. Weight Loss by Hers is designed to support you in reaching your goals with access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep the weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first ever GLP-1 pill for weight loss, so no needles necessary. And everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. And if prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door. No insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and much more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget if you're eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. So this is a weight loss designed to work with your life. So ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/detective to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/detective. One more time, that's forhers.com/detective. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is a registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com. All right, you guys are going to know who this next sponsor is as soon as I start. It's a regular on this show. Yes, it's Smalls. Yes, we love them. They make fresh, human-grade food for cats. It's made from the same stuff you or I would eat, but formulated specifically to help cats thrive. And you know what we're about to do next. It's your favorite game from Smalls. I'm talking about false or fact. So, false or fact, the first ingredients in most grocery store cat food is water and corn. That is a fact. Most cat food is filled with water and fillers. That's really it. False or fact, some cat food brands use the same meat grade you'd find in a hot dog. Unfortunately, true. 4D meat from dead, dying, deceased, or disabled animals is technically legal in pet food. Shouldn't be, but it is. And we got to make sure that we don't feed that to our cats. False or fact, a bag of cat food labeled natural has zero legal definition behind it. And as scary as that sounds, that is also true. The word natural is largely unregulated in the pet food industry. So be careful out there. Last one, false or fact, some cat foods contain so much carbohydrate filler that they're actually closer to a granola bar than they are a prey animal. And you've been here before, you know it's true. Unfortunately, dry kibble can be 30 to 50% carbs, despite cats having almost no dietary need for them. You have to look at it from the perspective of high quality food is an investment in your cat's health. We've all been there. Vet bills can rack up into the thousands of dollars. And so you have to look at buying good food as a way of maybe lowering those bills. And that's because Smalls fresh, gently cooked food is made without preservatives. It's a balanced diet and it leads to less shedding, fewer hairballs, and more silky shine on those fur coats. Smalls cat food leads to high protein and improved hydration. That equals strong bones and toned muscles. And for anybody who has a cat, you probably already know this, but cats use protein as their main source of energy. More protein means more fuel, means more sustained energy. So stop serving your little carnivore a bowl of processed shortcuts. For a limited time, because you are a Detective Perspective listener or viewer, get 60% off your first order plus free shipping and free treats for life. Your cat's ears just perked up. All you have to do is head to smalls.com/detective. One last time, that's 60% off your first order plus free shipping and free treats for life when you head over to smalls.com/detective. Cats, you're welcome. Okay, we're back from break, and as the investigation continued, investigators interviewed every staff member, reviewed old employee records, and looked into anyone who had worked at the museum in an official capacity, including electricians, carpenters, caterers, and art restorers. But they weren't getting any closer to recovering the artwork, which investigators firmly believed was still out there. According to them, stolen art is rarely destroyed because people tend to hold on to it, knowing it will be valuable to them at some point in the future. So, hoping to get the artwork back quickly, the museum offered a $1 million reward with no questions asked as long as everything was returned unharmed. But no one claimed it, and the investigation continued. By 1995, the statute of limitations for the charges related to the theft had expired. Anyone caught knowingly hiding, moving, or trying to sell the stolen artwork could still face charges. But the federal prosecutor's office publicly stated they would consider granting immunity to anyone who came forward. Still, no one did. And there were no big updates until 2013, on the 23rd anniversary of the heist, when the FBI announced a major development. They had, quote, identified the thieves, who are members of a criminal organization with a base in the mid-Atlantic states and New England. The FBI said they believed, quote, with a high degree of confidence that in the years after the theft, the art was transported to Connecticut and the Philadelphia region, and some of the art was taken to Philadelphia, where it was offered for sale by those responsible for the theft. However, after that attempted sale, which took place in 2003, the FBI's knowledge of the art's whereabouts was limited. They declined to provide any further details or name any names, which obviously spurred a bunch of rumors and accusations against different mob members, which was understandable at that time. You can tell by what they said and what they didn't say. They believed that this was some type of criminal organization, again, connected to the New England, Philadelphia area, which was at that time and is still has a large mafia presence. So they're just not as out there like they used to be. And so it's very possible, especially when you consider the fact that the thieves could have been career criminals, not necessarily art experts. But when we talk about the person I'm going to talk about in the perspective, you will see that there does appear to be some mob ties that may actually prove that what people believe and some of the speculation out there, it may be spot on. They declined to provide any further details or name any names, which obviously spurred a bunch of rumors and accusations against different mob members. In fact, in 2015, outlets began reporting that investigators suspected the mobster thieves were George Reisfelder and Leonard DiMuzio, and both of these individuals worked for mobster Carmelo Merlino. The theory remained that the men had stolen the artwork to use as a bargaining chip later, possibly with the help of security guard Rick. Investigators have noted that George and Leonard resembled police sketches of the thieves, and George did drive a red Dodge Daytona, similar to the car that the students saw outside the museum. And if that wasn't enough, George's brother also claimed he saw one of the stolen pieces of art inside George's apartment. Unfortunately, George and Leonard both died in 1991, while Carmelo died in 2005. Before his death, Carmelo denied having any of the stolen art, but told the FBI he might know who did. Obviously, if you know the mob, he never provided any evidence that led to the art. No surprise there. And by the way, I'm going to talk about a theory in the perspective, and I also know that there's some other theories out there as well that people do believe in. But from what I've gathered, and I think most of you will agree with me, this theory is the most prominent one that when you search it out, this is one that pops up right away. And I will say the one that I'm going to mention is out there as well, but you got to dig a little deeper. Now, since 2015, very little new information has been released, but the museum and the FBI investigations remain active. Both parties firmly believe the artwork is still out there, possibly now in the hands of people who don't even know it's stolen, something that's common with generational art. But prosecutors have said over and over again that even if someone knows they have one of the stolen pieces, they are still offering the possibility of immunity. The museum has also said the artwork can be returned with no questions asked, and they're now offering a $10 million reward, and whoever returns it can remain anonymous. At this point, no one appears to be interested in prosecution. Everyone just wants the artwork back where it belongs, inside that museum where the public can see it. Until that happens, empty frames will remain on the walls of the museum, quote, as a placeholder for the missing works and as symbols of hope awaiting their return. All right, so let's dive into this perspective, and I know I keep teasing this person. I'm going to talk about him in just a few moments. Just bear with me. I want to start with just the overall opinion of this case, and there's not a lot to discuss here because I agree with the FBI's assessment. I believe this is somehow involved with organized crime. There were multiple thefts happening throughout that area and in the surrounding communities where it was a similar MO. They were using these paintings as bargaining chips, but they were also being shipped out of the country, possibly from New York, Philadelphia area, stuff like that. So to think that these were career criminals, bad people, but maybe not experts in art, and they were using it you know, to gain money, to gain power, influence, right? Because maybe someone in this country or overseas wanted these pieces and they're willing to pay top dollar. The mob was organized, but they were going to do what they had to do to make money. And this was a way to make a lot of money really fast, right? 81 minutes in and out, and you're millionaires. If you look at it from that perspective, it's a pretty good return on investment. So that's my overall opinion. And just to kind of reaffirm that opinion, I want to talk about an individual now that was brought up to me and suggested to me many years ago. And this is someone who's a public figure to a certain degree. His name's Miles Connor. And Miles Connor is known as one of the greatest art thieves of all time. And he's pulled off multiple heists. He's gone to prison a lot. And he's not some like secretive person. He's been on Netflix. He's written a book. Really fascinating character who happens to live, not going to say where, but pretty close to me. And we have mutual friends. I'll just say that. There was a night where I could have met Miles and sat down and talked with him, but I was out of the state working. But there were some discussions on the phone while he was there, and it was an interesting conversation. He was hanging out with some friends. I didn't talk to him directly. And essentially, Miles has always claimed that he knows exactly what happened at the Gardner Museum. He was in prison at the time, but he had basically went to that museum with this individual and kind of cased the place, and then nothing came to fruition at the time. But the person that he was with, and that individual's name was Bobby Donati, who was connected to organized crime, had told him this is what he wanted to do and this is what he was thinking, and they kind of went over everything. And according to Miles Connor, while he was in prison, Bobby Donati, who he knew had been casing the Gardner Museum, linked up with a guy by the name of David Hooten. And these were the two guys who went in. These were the two police officers. So they go in and they rob the place. They take the paintings. And apparently, according to Miles, and Miles may have even said that he had gone down there with him. Don't hold me to that. But they go to the New York area and they're going to ship these paintings overseas to Europe. And at the time, there was some problems because, as I mentioned at the top of the show, some of the paintings were damaged. And to these collectors who were paying a lot of money, that was a big deal, right? Just any little nick in these paintings was a big deal, never mind cutting them out of the frames. So because these guys were inexperienced and didn't think about that initially when they took the first couple of pieces of artwork, that was a big issue. And from what I know, and my information is very limited with Miles, I don't know if that transaction ever went through or only partially went through, but according to Miles, from what he knows and what he's gathered over the years, and he's pretty confident about this, that these two guys did it, he says that Rick had nothing to do with it. And according to him, Rick and Randy were just wrong place, wrong time. Bobby and Danny are the ones that pulled this off. He's confident about that from what he's gathered over the years. In fact, I believe he said that David came to him later and said, yeah, we were going to use one of the Rembrandts to get a lower sentence for you. That was the plan. They never did, but he said that was kind of the idea until things took a different turn. I also wanted to mention that, and you could take this with a grain of salt, that according to Bobby and what he's talked about, Rick and Randy had nothing to do with the crime. They were just two guys that were there, wrong place, wrong time. He doesn't believe they were connected because essentially they wouldn't be needed. Exactly what these guys did as far as dressing up as police officers, and based on the, you know, the reconnaissance that they had done, this tactic basically would have worked on anybody who was working there at the time, and they didn't really need an in. They were able to execute the plan essentially without Rick or Randy's help. And I will say that earlier today, I reached out to my friend slash colleague who's friends with Miles and asked him if he was still in touch with him. He said he was, and that he could put us in contact with each other. But based on what we do here and just covering the case itself, I didn't know if that was something you guys would be interested in. Please let me know in the comments section if that's someone you'd like to hear from. I will say, and it's not too much of a secret, I have a new show that I'm going to be doing, hopefully by the end of this year. It's going to be more of an interview style show. And he was someone I was thinking about bringing on because he has a lot of stories to tell, not just this one. So I thought maybe that would be a better setting, but please let me know what you think. And if you do want to hear from Miles or people like that, where we can have conversations about some of the things they did from the perspective of learning how their mind works, so we can not only help identify these people in the future, but learn from it so that we can prevent it from happening again. Again, I'm open to it. Let me know what you guys think. But to recap this episode or to wrap it up, is there people out there that knows what happened and who's responsible? Absolutely. 100%. That pool is pretty small, because if more people knew with the amount of money that's available right now, I'd like to think that someone would have ratted. Someone would have came forward. So my best guess is that the people who were directly involved with it, most of them are dead. In fact, before I forget, Bobby is dead. He was killed. David died of a heart attack. So those guys are gone. If they were involved, they're gone. And as I mentioned earlier, the other people who have been tied to this are also dead. So those immediate people, regardless of who it was, maybe it's a little bit of all of them, they're all gone. And they may have taken that secret to their grave, especially if those paintings were sent overseas or a remote area of the country. More than likely, those paintings are in someone's vault and have only been seen by a few select eyes. There's not a lot of people out there that knows where those paintings are now. And I told you guys at the top of the show, I am by no means a painting expert. Most of the paintings in my house are from Home Goods. Shout out to them. I like them. But yeah, this is something where the people who are purchasing these items are so rich, they don't have to show people. It's more of something just to have, to brag about, and to keep in their close circle of probably associates who are also in criminal activities or involved in those types of things. And it sounds like a movie, but that's probably what we're looking at here, because if it wasn't, I think by now, at least one of these pieces would have turned up. And so more than likely they're still all together and they may be just with one or two people. But just in case there's anybody out there who has something that could get this case going again, or may put us on a path to finding at least a couple of the pieces of artwork, I want to give you a recap of what we have here. Okay. So in the early morning hours of March 18th, 1990, two men posing as police officers entered the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston and restrained the security guards. Over the next 81 minutes, the men stole 13 works of art worth $500 million. More than 36 years later, none of the artwork has been recovered, and no one has ever been charged with the heist. Anyone with information is asked to contact the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum Security Director at 617-278-5114 or reward@gardnermuseum.org. Confidentiality is assured, and a $10 million reward is available. As always, guys, thank you for listening. Like I said, 150th episode. We've done a lot of good here. We are just getting started. Thank you for allowing me to tell this story, because this is something that I needed to get off my chest and out of my brain, and I'm happy I got to share it with you guys. That's going to do it for me. Everyone stay safe out there, and I'll see you soon.